Successful software starts at Raygun.com. Raygun APM provides .NET application performance monitoring unlike anything you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers more than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one powerful solution. You can monitor unlimited hosts, enjoy richer trace data and call stack information, and unblock those hard-to-solve performance bottlenecks that affect your web and mobile apps. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality and try Raygun free at raygun.com. That's R-A-Y-G-U-N.com today. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Jeremy Kuhn. He has written a programmer's introduction to mathematics, which is all over my timeline on Twitter. He currently works at Google and he's a PhD in mathematics. How are you, doctor?
Hi, Scott. I'm doing good.
That's pretty exciting. You know, it's the holiday season right now that we're recording this. And I'm just wondering, if you're a PhD in mathematics, what's that like when you go to like Christmas? Is that just awkward or are you in a room full of other PhDs in mathematics?
Oh, well, my wife and I actually met in math class, so we sort of keep it in the family, and her parents are both math and science teachers, so we get some discussion, but I think they also kind of get sick and tired of math, and so during the holidays, we do like woodworking and dig holes in the yard and plant trees and stuff.
Very cool. It's important to have balance. That's great. Well, everyone is talking about this book because it is a very clear audience. You're basically saying that, you know, for the last almost half decade, you've been working on a book for programmers who may have found math to be a barrier. So like that's your audience, people who are listening to this show.
Yeah.
So 4 years though, like
4 years. Yeah. Well, so it was kind of interesting because I started the book as a graduate student. Mm-hmm. Kind of just thinking like, oh, I've been writing this blog and people are reading it. Maybe it'd be good to start a book. Mm-hmm. And I had some ideas for sort of the beginning of the book, and the beginning came very easily. And I wrote it in a couple of months, maybe mm-hmm. the first 100 or 150 pages. And then I, you know, had to finish a thesis. I moved across the country. I changed jobs. I mm-hmm. got married and all these things sort of happened, right when I was getting to sort of the more difficult parts of the book, when I had to sort of like edit myself more. So that was part of why it took so long.
How do you scope something like that? I'm looking at you have a great Medium post, and I'm going to include links to all the show notes and everything that we mentioned. So there's a great Medium post on what it's like to publish this book, self-publishing a great book. You pretty much said that the first 100 pages kind of just fell out of you, but then you're not trying to write the grand book of all things math, right? This could be a 1,000-page book.
Right. Yeah. And it was getting pretty long even at the beginning. I think so. Some topics I think are sort of in the book, I wanted to focus on the topics that if you sort of internalize those and get to a sort of higher meta level of understanding for that topic, then mm-hmm. learning the adjacent topics becomes much easier. One example is probability theory. So probability theory and statistics are sort of couched in all of this interesting language. But if you have a strong understanding of sets and arguments about counting and sort of the basis that I laid out in the chapter on sets, I think it becomes suddenly much easier to learn probability theory.
Yeah, you mentioned in your Medium post that you want the reader to internalize certain things and bring really make them a fundamental part of who they are so that they might find it easier later on to understand a concept.
Right. And I think that the most of the things that people learn in school are oriented around computation. Mm-hmm. So when you learn calculus, you compute derivatives of various things and you compute confusing integrals. But you don't necessarily spend a lot of time on the foundation understanding, first of all, why are we following these rules to compute this thing? And what can we do when we compute these things necessarily? Somehow you graduate with a computer science degree and you know calculus, but then you don't know what you can use it for and you don't exactly know why it made sense in the first place. So part of the goal of this book, at least for the topics it covers, is to give you maybe a one or two sentence understanding of like, okay, here is exactly what the derivative is for, why it's useful, and I can fit that all in one little nugget in my head. And then there's the part where you say, we're going to translate that conceptual understanding into a representation that is useful and accessible for computers. And so we sort of had the representation that's accessible for computers, but not necessarily the high level understanding and not necessarily the conversion from the high level understanding to the computational representation and back again. And that sort of shows up everywhere in math. So mm-hmm. that shows up with linear algebra, that shows up with calculus, that shows up with statistics. And so I'm sort of doing a deep dive on some specific topics to show this pattern. And then when you go out and you read some other thing about probability or statistics, then you'll be able to see that pattern happening and help. It will help you guide your understanding.
How much do you assume that the programmer is a programmer? Is this, you know, it is called a programmer's introduction to mathematics, not an introduction to mathematics. This is not math 101. It's through the lens of I am a programmer. Is this something that, you know, a code newbie or someone who's only a couple of years into their career can do? Or how senior must I be?
I use a lot of analogies in the book. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you have no idea how a compiler works, the analogies that I make about compilers might fall flat. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, aside from being able to read the programs that are the sort of driving applications at the end of each chapter, aside from being able to read and use those to help you understand the math, you don't necessarily need to be some senior developer at some company, at, you know, some big company to be able to learn the math.
That's great. One of the analogies that really worked for me was, I think, in chapter two, where you start talking about polynomials. And, you know, you go into polynomials and I'm thinking you're going to start using all kinds of Greek lettering and things I don't understand. And then suddenly public static void main shows up. And I'm like, I know that. And look, and he syntax highlighted it. It's all attractive and wonderful. And you make a really great point where how many months did we as junior and beginner programmers type public static void main without really understanding what each of those individual things means? And as I teach my 13-year-old polynomials, I'm realizing I'm taking a lot for granted as well.
Yeah, I think there's and actually when I first wrote that chapter, I didn't have that in it, and I had the definition of the polynomial where it has the formula with the symbols in it, and I showed it to someone who didn't really know any math at all, and they looked at that one page and then they just closed the book and said, "No, I can't read this." And so I had to put some work into that, because, you know, people will look at a math formula on a piece of paper and their eyes will just glaze over. And that happens to me too, even as sort of an advanced user of mathematics. I'll look at something I'm not familiar with, and it will take me a few seconds of going back over it to really understand and penetrate the different pieces and say, okay, what's this piece doing? What's this piece doing? And I think programmers had that experience when they're learning their first programming language, and maybe once you've been working in the industry for a few years, you sort of forget those struggles you went through. Mm. And at least recalling those struggles might make you more sensitive or more amenable to the same struggles that you have when you're learning math, because it can be frustrating.
Yeah. And you call out the very, very beginning, the whole intro to the book is you remind us that mathematics has a culture. And just as we enter the programming culture and you find yourself in a room that you're not really comfortable in, you're like, this is awkward. These people are using words I don't understand. The same is to be expected when starting or restarting one's intro into mathematics.
Yeah. And even beyond just the words that are being used, there's a lot of unwritten expectations when you're reading a math book. It's even more difficult when you're reading a math book. It's like reading someone's source code when you don't have any of their design notes or any forum to talk about. You just see the code. When you're reading a math book, there's sort of some expectations. When someone writes down a definition, for example, you're mm-hmm. supposed to come up with a specific example, like a unit test that you are going to use to guide the rest of your understanding as you read. So when I'm reading a math book, I'll see some definition. My eyes will glaze over. Okay, I'll get over that. And then I'll write down some unit testing, write down the most simple example you can think of, and then write down slightly more complicated examples until you understand what the heart of this definition is. And then later, when you're reading some fact that they're proving about this definition, you can then use those examples as test cases against the arguments that are on the paper. And this is something that I don't think I've ever seen this explained in a math book, that this is how you're supposed to read math. but that's just what everyone does. And if you aren't if you don't have like a teacher that's telling you this is how you're supposed to do it, then you're just not going to know and you're going to be confused.
Do you really, you said your eyes glaze over, but again, there's also the intimidation factor of like, I've got a PhD in mathematics and I, you know, barely got a C in calculus. I'm looking at it, one of the formulas somewhere, I don't know, 30, 40 pages in, where you start introducing sum and product, and we start getting into like symbols and you know, sigma and pi, and you know the density and the intensity of a math formula. Does your eyes really glaze over? Do you have to parse it and disassemble it, or do you read that with fluency, like you read English?
Well, for the products and sums, I think I read that pretty fluently. But there, you know, the higher up in math you get, the more abstraction layers are sort of painted on top of this. So for example, sums and products are sort of, you can understand those in terms of arithmetic. And then in sort of later stages of math, probably beyond what most programmers would have a need to learn about, you see that product starts to mean something different. And so then when you see the product symbol, you have to sort of remember, okay, what context is this product happening in? Is it happening in this context or this other context? And then they will start to do like, okay, there's one, I don't know if you know, the product symbol looks like a big gate, like a pi symbol, a capital pi. There's a different symbol called the coproduct where they turn that symbol upside down. And so like they just keep having new ideas and they keep adding new words to explain these new ideas because they're just aren't any words that exist to explain them. And so you can keep getting more and more complicated stuff. And for me, it's like I never stop learning math, right? Like if I'm learning polynomials for the first time, my eyes are glazing over the same way as if I'm reading some paper about category theory where they're introducing some new idea for the first time.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I've programmed in Java, I programmed in Pascal, I programmed in C sharp, but I'm trying to read Swift and I'm trying to read Objective-C, and I'm looking at these symbols and I'm like, what does that do? Are we redefining this thing? And it's even worse when you reuse keywords that mean one thing in one language and not in another.
Yeah. And in like languages like Perl, where the operators are sometimes implicit, this is a lot like math, where there are things happening behind the scenes that are contextual. And once you become super comfortable with the context, then it really makes sense why they explain the math that way. It's much quicker to write down. It's quicker to understand. It's quicker to get to the heart of the thing that you want to analyze. But then if you're coming at it from a new perspective and you don't have any of that context, you're just kind of hopelessly lost.
Yeah. One of the things that made me realize that this was definitely a book that I was going to enjoy was somewhere around 20, 30 pages in, the first time you went side by side, you kind of split screen and you said, all right, here's the math. Here's the equivalent program. And I think I stared at that probably for 30 minutes, just making absolutely sure that I understand. And it also showcases, like I mentioned before, the density of math and perhaps some of the verbosity of programs that are at least, you know, programs that aren't functional programs.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was an undergraduate, before I had ever discovered math, by the way, I didn't discover math as a passion until I was halfway through my undergraduate and I'd already been doing a bunch of computer science. But I was in a course and I was sort of talking with a professor and I had this idea in my head that math was like the most rigorous possible way to express logic ever, right? Like it's math and it's theorems and that's it. And my professor, who kind of knew better than me, he said, are you kidding? Programming is way more precise and way more logical than math. Math is sloppy. And I was like taken aback by that. And it wasn't until years later when I'd been studying math for a long time and could compare the two that I was like, yeah, he's right. Math is more like an English language. I mean, it's closer to English language than programming is to English language because you can just be a lot more flexible with the way you express ideas in math. And that's a double-edged sword.
Interesting. I'm curious, did you consciously not pick a functional language? You did this in Java, not in Scala, for example, because it would look too much like math?
The book, most of the code in the book is in Python.
Python, pardon me.
Because I think that it's easiest to read that pseudocode.
My bad.
Right. Even if you don't, even if you don't write Python, I think it's easier.
Yeah, I'm looking at code that's got curly braces. I didn't get into the depths of the thing, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I'll from time to time I'll slip in an example from like Java or C or Haskell just to make an analogy. But all of the actual code is written in Python. There's one demo that I wrote in JavaScript, but just because it needed D3.
Okay, so I'm curious though, why you picked like an imperative programming as opposed to a functional.
I think just because of the audience, I think more people are familiar with Python than they are with Haskell or Racket or Scheme. Personally, I spend a lot more time writing in Python, so that was easier for me as well.
Okay, so it was more about the language choice and not about like the language family.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Hey, folks, you're a very good developer, probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. So what is it that you think is fundamentally causing math to be hard? Is it that we all as a collective community bump up against calculus? Is that the hump that we all need to get over and then math will be not so hard?
I definitely don't think so. I think I didn't really get calculus the first time around either, even though I'd passed my classes. I think part of it, there's a lot of sort of intermingling causes. I think part of it is expectations. We spent, even if you've been programming for 5 years in industry, you've spent as much of your life doing math in school as you have doing software. And so it seems kind of unfair that you shouldn't have an easier time understanding math, considering how much time you devoted to it, as you do for software. So there's sort of that weird skew. And then another thing is that most of the interesting math for programming is written by mathematicians for other mathematicians. And so there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of that missing context. And there's all the formulas. And I think because they're writing from a mathematician to another mathematician, they have a different expectation of what's interesting and what it needs to be conveyed. So for example, this is one of the, I think, biggest differences between math and programming. Even though I think they share a lot of similarities, programming is primarily about what you can do. Right? You want to write programs that automate some task or achieve some goal or analyze some data. Math and kind of the math that is not necessarily directly about applications is more about why something is true. It's more about gaining a better human understanding of a mathematical topic, which is, I don't know, does that need a little bit of a breaking down what that means?
I think it would be helpful.
So the difference is sort of in how a human understands what the intrinsic characteristics of a thing are. So for example, I don't know, this might be a little bit too high level, but there is this thing in calculus called the Taylor series. And the Taylor series are incredibly useful tool for mathematicians. But if you take a calculus class, you sort of see it once and you're tested on it, and then you never really use it again. Or maybe you might use it once in some engineering class or something. But it turns out that I think the Taylor series is one of the more applicable parts of calculus to programming and algorithm design, because the sort of internal nugget of what makes Taylor series useful is that it provides the most accurate approximation of some function by a line. Or by a polynomial of increasingly large degree. So
if I may, is this the mathematical equivalent of a fairly accurate guesstimate?
Yeah, exactly. And the point is that you can make your estimate, your guesstimate, more accurate by increasing more terms of the Taylor polynomial. And so if you say, you know, I want to make some trade-off in my web app where I have some amount of time that's being spent on computation and I can get some estimate of how much benefit I will get from spending more computation time, it might be really hard to compute what that curve of trade-off looks like, but you might be able to approximate it quite easily with a Taylor polynomial. Or the Taylor series. And so then you can say, all right, I'm going to use this as my approximation, and that will be, I can use that to determine what I should do, you know, how much time I should spend computing this thing.
Interesting. Okay. So that makes me feel a little bit like, and I'm speaking for the non-math programmers or the people who made it this far without using a lot of math, I think that a lot of us may be making decisions based on intuition or based on experience when there is good and hard and useful math behind it. And if we knew more about that, we'd be able to back up our guesses and our assumptions with real math, as opposed to just saying, well, this feels right.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. That's definitely a good reason.
I'm not trying to put people down. I think that people who are listening will have always had that time where someone on the team understands math better than they do, and we'll start having conversations about, you know, big O notation or whatnot, and they'll apply real math to a problem, and then we'll go, wow, you're right. If I had known more math, I would have been able to apply that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I think another thing that I want to sort of instill in the book is that not only does it let you sort of justify a piece of intuition, but I think it also opens a class of algorithms or solutions to problems that just were inconceivable without math. I don't know if that sounds enticing. I could maybe give some examples.
No, that is very enticing. I dig that.
So one example, there's this famous algorithm that has to do with secret sharing. I don't know if you have heard of secret sharing before.
I have, right. This is part of the beginning of RSA, like 30, 40 years ago.
Right. So the idea is that you have some sensitive piece of information, and you would like to sort of distribute the information among some people so that some group of them can come back together and reconstruct the secret. So I like the example of people fighting over a rich person's will. Like it's like they're all of their children that are fighting over the inheritance. And so the person wants to make sure that the children all cooperate. So they'll take their will, the text of their will, and they will use this secret sharing protocol so that each of the children get a piece of the secret. But unless, say that there's like 10 children, and at least 8 of them have to work together in order to even read the will. And they have to come together and get in a room and share their piece of the secret in order to read the will. And if any fewer of them, you know, 7 or fewer come together, then they can't get any information about what's in the will at all. And so the secret sharing scheme will work no matter how many children there are and no matter what size of group you want to be able to reconstruct the secret. And this seems kind of amazing, right?
Mm-hmm. This is like the fundamental basis of whether or not we can trust anyone.
Right. And it's useful for a lot of applications. For example, if you have a secret key and you would like to store that secret key on a server somewhere, that's pretty dangerous because someone might break into the server or the server, you know, the disk might fail. And so then you won't be able to get the secret. And so you might replicate that secret across 10 servers, but then any one of those servers is a single point of failure for an intrusion. So how are you going to replicate it in a way that is both resilient to server failures and resilient to intrusions? And one possibility is to use one of these secret sharing schemes. So you say each server gets one share of the secret, and you can, you know, tune your resilience. So if half of the servers fail, then you can use the other half to reconstruct the secret. But if an attacker breaks into any one server, they can't get any information about what the secret key is because they only see one of those little pieces.
This might be just a small bit of a detour, but why has the rise of computational power taken what are like things that we would have said are mathematically solid secret sharing schemes and then broken them? Are we just brute forcing our way through math just faster than we ever thought we could?
Like you're specifically talking about like encryption and
Like encryption and all these things where, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I would learn how something worked and how you know the basis is of RSA, and then we find that we've we've broken into this or broken into that because we just were able to calculate primes or calculate whatever faster than we could before.
Right. Yeah. So part of, well, one of the nice things about sort of approaching this from a math perspective is mm-hmm. that all of the cryptographic schemes that people come up with mm-hmm. have a parameter that lets you tune the security. So RSA, for example, you get to choose how many bits are in the primes that you're using for your private key. Mm-hmm. And we sort of, you said that people are getting better and better at factoring numbers into primes. Mm-hmm. And so that will break some RSA protocols. But if you just increase the security of the protocol, use like by tuning that parameter, you can mm-hmm. make it so that the factoring techniques won't work at all. So I think to some extent, you're right, where there's the side of solving these math problems faster and faster that makes lower levels of security kind of useless. Mm-hmm. And then the higher levels of security, sort of, you have to do efficiency trade-offs. So RSA with sort of a 4,000 bit key is kind of too inefficient to use for real-time encryption if you're having like a encrypted video stream or something. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they have to sort of come up with these other techniques based on elliptic curves and all that stuff. But I don't actually necessarily agree that it's brute force that's breaking all of these. To me, it seems like it's that they've sort of realized that brute force isn't going to help so much. And so they need the kind of social engineering that gets them a bank of people's insecure passwords and, you know, can do SIM swapping, or they can call someone on the phone and pretend to be a mother with a crying child and get the sympathy of the person to reset their account or something. Like, it seems like social engineering is really the winner in this mm-hmm. security battle. And that's sort of a testament to math succeeding at its job.
That's a great point. What I like about the way you're describing this and what I've enjoyed in the chapters of the books that I've read is that you're kind of encouraging the reader from a programmer's perspective to start kind of engaging with math that they bump into in the world more deeply. Like I'm just trying to explore and understand as I move through the world of security.
Yeah. And I think that there's actually a lot of really interesting applications. I think security is a very common one, and because it, you know, it's all over the internet, all the different break-ins and stuff, and all the postmortems. And I think another one, like you mentioned earlier, functional programming is mm-hmm. very common on the internet. So programmers like to sort of read about that. But I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff out there that goes beyond that into other domains. So one example I use in the book is this. Isn't from economics. There was this very famous and very successful algorithm that won a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago in economics. So I don't know if you've heard of the National Residency or Hospital Residency Matching Program.
No.
So this is the thing that happens basically when medical students graduate from their med school. They have to mm-hmm. do a residency in a hospital. And so there's so many hospitals and there's so many students, and they have to figure out a way to decide which student will go to which hospital. But you don't really want to, you know, leave that to its own devices, because you'll get all of the richest students, you know, bribing the best hospitals to take them. And, you know, it will be sort of bad as a society for the whole, because the poorer areas won't get as good students to, you know, serve their patients. So what the sort of the U.S. government decided to pay these researchers, the guy was Alvin Roth, who and Lloyd Shapley, who won the Nobel Prize, and they basically paid them to figure out, can we design a market that does not involve money, that can basically figure out how to assign hospitals to students in such a way that nobody's going to cheat. Nobody is going to have an incentive to go outside of the bounds of the system and make a side deal. And so they came up with this algorithm. It's called the stable marriage algorithm. And it's actually so simple enough that I think it's very close to the beginning of the book. And I don't think you need a lot of math to understand it. But it's super interesting. I don't want to give away the punchline, so you should go read the book. But it's sort of an example, one of my go-to examples of math that gets applied in super interesting scenarios that's outside of the things that programmers would typically see. And I think it's kind of useful because programmers are designing these online marketplaces and these online communities in which they literally get to hard code how the market works. And I think it's kind of useful to study markets. And if you're studying markets and the different mechanisms for like coming up with fairness in markets, then there's a lot of math that's accessible and interesting for that.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. People can check this out at PIMBook.org. This is a programmer's introduction to mathematics. That's what the PIM is for. And you've already put up the first pages. You can read like 45 pages for free, and you have self-published this. So you can purchase it through Gumroad. You can purchase it through Amazon. And you're building a whole community around this. You've already started to make a GitHub repository where you're going to start putting code in there and beginning to build interactive demos as well, which are pretty slick. I'm already looking at this eigenvector one here on waves and a beaded string. So I like the idea that soon or in the future, I'll be able to read the book and then go and see some of these things live in my browser.
Yeah. There's also a GitHub account for people discussing the different exercises in the book. So look out for that.
And that's at github.com/PIM-book. I'm going to put links to all of this stuff in the show notes from PIMBook.org, the GitHub, the experiments, and on and on and on. It's got to feel really great to be finished. I've written a couple of books, certainly not as awesome as this one. Do you think you're going to just be forever updating the book and make version 2 and version 3, or are you going to take a break?
I'll definitely, people have already started to find mistakes in the book. Small ones, nothing major. All the programs still do what I promise they do. So that's what matters. Actually my sort of next project I've been thinking about ever since I tell people I've been making this book, A Programmer's Introduction to Mathematics, all of my mathematician friends have been desperately asking me for the converse book, A Mathematician's Introduction to Programming. So I might have to do that next.
Oh my goodness. Well, certainly if you do that, you've got to do the exact same cover, except just flip it upside down like the pro product. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jeremy Kuhn, for chatting with me today.
Thanks for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.